I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month. Are you ready? This might be up a little loud. Are you, now I need to turn it back up a little bit because there's a filter.
Thank you for that physical humor gag.
I'm ready.
Hello and welcome to, what are we going to call it? Is it like Witch Please Season 2?
How long can I go?
Don't know.
That's it. Nope.
Second wind.
No. Okay.
That was impressive. Hello and welcome to season two of Witch Please, a fortnightly-ish podcast about the Harry Potter world. I'm Hannah McGregor.
And I'm Marcel Cosman. Are we going to have a new numbering system for season two?
Guaranteed. We're going to need somebody to invent a new series of numbers so that we can number these episodes. Fuck. We'll think of it. But we are doing things a little bit differently for this season. So over the past few months, Marcel and I have been traveling around and recording some conversations with some interesting Harry Potter fans who we've met in various ways. So the first four episodes of this season are going to feature conversations that we had separately with people that we met on our various travels. And here's the format that you are going to encounter in these next few episodes. We're going to start off with this tight, seamless introduction where we tell you a little bit about the context of these trips and what we were doing and the people that we met. And then we're going to segue you over into the conversations, and then we'll come back to say goodbye to you. So stick around to the end because we have a fun new feature coming up at the end of these new episodes.
Also, you may notice that Hannah and I are in the same room. We will be in the same room for some of these episodes. That's awesome! This is the new sound effect. It's just me snapping my fingers with my whole body. Yeah, so Hannah and I are in the same room, which is amazing because we hardly ever get to be in the same room anymore. Sometimes we're going to be in the same room and sometimes we're going to be via Skype as we have been in the past. And which one we will be on a given day is going to be a mystery, so you can tune in to find out.
Also, we're currently drinking this red wine that tastes a little carbonated. So tastes a little bit like red wine soda pop.
I thought it was just because I was hungover, but it's not.
No. It's a mystery wine, but that's fine. So this first episode, we've decided that for these first four episodes that are about our various exciting travels, we're going to go in chronological order. So the first event that you are going to hear about was my visit to London and my attending Cursed Child live with London-based books journalist Anna James, who, listen, she's a big deal and also a very kind and generous person, and managed to help me get my hands on some tickets to The Cursed Child and came to it with me. And we had really good seats, and then we got to see some theater. And I'm going to tell you my number one takeaway was, I don't know if you know this, but theater's really good.
I know. Right? No, wait. I feel like this needs to be qualified.
Okay.
Good theater is really good.
I feel a little bit like when I was reading The Cursed Child and we were talking about it and I was thinking about it, I sort of had forgotten how good theater can be.
What are some things that stand out to you as representative of what made the production good?
The first thing, and you're going to hear Anna say this, but the first thing that really stood out is that the script actually hasn't changed much. Like, I sort of anticipated there being more revisions between the version that we read and the version that's on the stage. It's very similar, but the actors are so good that they're selling some of the jankier lines.
Whoa.
Like, there's still some lines in there that you're like, that might not be the best written line, but the actors are just like, everybody is full on in those characters. So the cast is remarkable in all kinds of ways. One of the things that, again, sort of seeing it live really reminded me of is how big theater can be. You can take emotions to a much higher pitch than you can really pull off. Like, you know, the naturalistic mode of acting we expect in most movies these days means that emotions need to be small and internalized and subtly registered via twitchy faces. And
or like Ryan Gosling's long quiet stares.
I was like, or Casey Affleck's long quiet stares, right? It's like so much of great acting is like a white man staring in total silence into the distance.
But like, we love it when white men are silent. So let's not discount the value of white men's silence. Let's celebrate that.
I'm glad they're silent. I just wish I wasn't having to look at them so much. Could they be silent and also not on the screen? That would be great.
Are we asking for so much?
So the guy who played Harry Potter, for example, I've forgotten all of their names. When he has those like Voldemort nightmares, like he wakes up screaming, and the emotional impact of having a real live human on a stage in front of you actually screaming at the top of their lungs, that's intense. Mm-hmm. That's a level of intensity that like I just don't think you get in any other kind of experience.
Well, and especially because you're in the room with him, right? Yeah. So I'm curious. We do this thing when we teach drama to first years where we sort of explain what the fourth wall is and breaking the fourth wall and how the fourth wall is a new thing, because in Shakespeare's time, there was no fourth wall. People just like threw shit at the actors on stage and the actors had to act around it.
Yeah.
But now you go into a theater and the actors just pretend that you're not there. Was this that style of theater where like, we just imagine that you are in the room with Harry and Ginny as Harry is having nightmares? Is it that level of intimacy? Or is it like, I think what I really want to know is, did you forget that you were sitting in a theater watching this happen?
That's so interesting, because so I'm going to answer your question sideways, which is later on in the same week that I saw this, I went to the Globe with my friend Helen and saw Romeo and Juliet. And like, you can't put on a sort of naturalist fourth wall-y production in the Globe. It doesn't work in that space. Like, that kind of theater presumes a particular shape of actual room people are watching it in, where everybody's looking at the stage from the same angle. And the Globe Theater on the Round, like, it just
Like, you can see other people in the audience.
Yeah. Like, you can see everybody. You can all see each other, and you can't see a lot of the stage depending on where you're sitting. And so that, like, the Romeo and Juliet production we saw was so spectacular in the sense of, like, it was spectacle. It was loud and over the top. And, yeah, like, during the balcony scene, Romeo was, like, in the crowd with the groundlings, which is, you can get really cheap tickets at the Globe where you just stand at the stage level. And so, like, Romeo was just there walking through the crowd saying, like, excuse me. Like, it was exactly that, like, not even breaking of the fourth wall, just the fourth wall.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah, there's no such thing as the fourth wall. And I would say that there was something in The Cursed Child that was almost more, like, postmodern, almost more Brechtian in the sort of the way that it was picking up on the naturalist expectations of theater and then pushing them a little bit in some interesting ways. So the stage setting itself is not a naturalist setting. It's very interpretive. It's very gestural. Like, you know, it's a black stage and the opening scene is in platform 9 3/4. So there's some sort of arches that represent the fact that you're in a train station and some suitcases. And then those arches and those suitcases, along with a couple of movable walls and staircases, become the sort of major props. And when it's time for it to be a new scene, some extras in Hogwarts robes come out and move some stairs. And now you're in a different scene. So it's very like, this is theater. You are looking at theater. We're not trying to make you feel immersed in it. But simultaneously, you're not there. The actors never acknowledge you. They never break the fourth wall. In fact, I felt like the way that the production was trying to situate the audience was as witnesses. So, you know, Brecht's critique of naturalist theater was that it lets you sort of be a passive viewer. You're not implicated in the action on stage. And he wanted to sort of bring the audience in and make them feel politically implicated in what was happening. And I felt emotionally implicated in what was happening. And that came to a real peak in, there's going to be just a bajillion spoilers in this.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Commence Obliviate in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
But that scene right at the end where Voldemort arrives and Harry and his family bear witness to Voldemort killing Harry's parents. And what happens is that they all come to the front of the stage, right up against the edge of the stage. Voldemort walks down the stairs through the audience and out the back. And everybody on the stage, all of the actors, are watching something that's happening behind us. And we have to watch them watching it, which is hard. It is really hard. And there was this really interesting thing that happened where people in the audience were turning around and trying to see something that wasn't there. And so it felt at once like, I know I'm not in this scene. I know I'm not here, but I feel like I am part of what's going on right now. And I feel like something is being asked of me as a member of the audience.
Would you go again?
In a second. Yeah, absolutely. Anna, it was her third time seeing it. And she was like, yes, it is still good every time. Like, it's going to continue being a production in London for years and years and years and years and years. Like, they'll just keep changing the cast.
So, okay. When we were reading it, I remember we were talking a little bit about how we would be interested to see a Hermione who experiences racialization come out a little bit more clearly, as opposed to just like, oh, Hermione happens to be black and her job is complicated because it's a complicated job. Like, one of our critiques of the books in a lot of ways was like, it imagines a world where racism qua racism doesn't exist because we metaphorize racism through house elves. Yeah, so I'm curious how that plays out live on stage.
I didn't see it. Like, I didn't see any additional attention to sort of the racialization of Hermione as a character. But there might be things there that are not necessarily legible to me or that I would catch on a reviewing. One thing I will say is that I remember reading the play and thinking that Rose Granger Weasley was sort of underserved as a character, that we don't get a ton of her. And there is more of her in the play in the same way that there's more of a number of characters, including Ginny, because there's a whole bunch of scenes where people are on stage but not speaking, but still doing interesting things. So, for example, there's a scene where it's the scene after the second time they've changed time, I think. They have been caught, and McGonagall is sort of reaming everybody out and sort of explaining what happened, and like, Rose was gone. Like, you essentially killed somebody. And this isn't in the script, but on the stage, there's a whole bunch of Hogwarts students, like, listening in on the conversation. And there's this moment after everybody else has cleared out where you see, like, Rose sort of steps down off the stage, and it's her sort of grappling with the, like, I didn't exist. I was written out of existence. And Hermione sees her across the stage, and it's a totally silent scene where it's like this moment of them making eye contact and like coming to terms with what that actually meant, and then like come across the stage to each other and embrace. And it's just a really stunning scene that gave you just in that moment a sense of like Hermione's relationship to her daughter and how much she loves her children, which it's not really in the script. In the script, it's mostly sort of Ron is the parent and Hermione is the career woman. And that I found that moment incredibly powerful, of like sort of the mother and daughter's exchange, unscripted, but still very present.
This is really interesting and really points to a number of ways that writing and releasing a script for a play that was still being workshopped is complicated. Because so at the beginning you were saying that the script is relatively similar, it didn't change a lot, but the blocking very clearly changed a ton, and it sounds like there are like almost whole scenes that get left out of the script because they either hadn't been blocked or there's no reason to include it because you can't capture it in language. And so it made me think of how a friend of mine is taking a writing workshop and a writing course, and we were talking recently just about the like the things that you would never think about unless somebody was explaining to you how writing a novel works. Yeah. And she was like, yeah, we learned the other day that you don't advance plot through dialogue. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. And we were both just like, of course,
yeah.
Of course. And this is exactly what you're talking about. That moment between Hermione and Rose is a moment you can't, there's no point in capturing that transformation or like recognition or whatever in dialogue. It would be so like it would be so schlocky and gross.
Yeah.
But you can have this really powerful silent moment which is just all blocking.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, there are many more moments like that that you're right absolutely invite the question, are those things that you always knew were going to happen but it didn't even make sense to try to write them in because they're so performance based, or are they things that they wanted to add in later, but they felt like we can't really add in tons of new dialogue because the script's out there in the world. So we're going to add stuff in via just sort of blocked scenes or unspoken scenes, or there's dance sequences. There's some beautiful dance sequences. You know what it makes me think of is, and it reminded me of, Hamilton, which is, you know, the other sort of big cultural phenomenon of the last couple of years. And Lin-Manuel Miranda has talked about how important it was to him that the studio recording, the cast recording, be really, really good, but that he deliberately left one really important song out of it because he wanted there to still be something that was special about the live event. And there's this song in Hamilton where Aaron Burr is talking about what it's like to be left out of politics and power, and he sings about how he wants to be in the room where it happens.
I want to be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
And it's still, it's about like this proximity to the thing itself, that like There is just something irreplaceable about actually being there rather than having something communicated to you after the fact. And it's so, like, I'm still sort of really wrapping my head around that in an era when content is free, when we expect content to be free, people are still willing to pay for events. But the democratic promise of the internet, which is that we can all participate in things no matter where we are, the event precludes that. You can't, like, you have to be in a place to participate in an event. And Cursed Child is a remarkable performance, and it's, like, by its very nature, deeply exclusionary. Most of the people in the world will never be able to see it.
This makes me think a little bit about my friend Nikki's phrase of, I think, 2015, mm-hmm. which was, can it be both? What you're saying makes so much sense, that there is always going to be some kind of exclusion, mm-hmm. but that also something is lost when you don't save anything special for the inclusion. And not everyone can participate in all the things. Mm-hmm. And that maybe that's okay, and that the problem is when people can't participate in any of the things. Mm-hmm. And when we don't take seriously the things that people can participate in, or we don't see those things as, like, real or legitimate or good enough or whatever. Because, mm-hmm. like, I will never be able to attend the London Witch Please meetup that you had. And you know what? That sounds like it was amazing. And I had a little bit of FOMO leading up to it. But as I tweeted, everybody seemed like they had such an incredibly glorious time that I don't feel like, I don't feel bitter about having missed that. I'm really glad that it happened. Yeah. And I think that what I would like in the world, if I may utopianize this conversation, if I may wax utopia for a moment, wax utopic. I would like to live in a world where so many profoundly beautiful things are happening, and everybody gets to do things that are special and remarkable, to the degree in which when you hear about a beautiful thing or an empowering thing or a profound thing that happens that you couldn't go to, you could never go to, you would never go to, whatever, instead of being sad about that, you're just so happy for those people. I think that's the world that I want to live in. Not a world where, like, everything is for everyone or everything is only for the rich and powerful. I want something better.
Like, meeting interesting people and having conversations with them is not an experience that's premised on scarcity. It's an experience that's premised on plenitude. Like,
proximity.
Yeah. There's always going to be more interesting people to meet, and maybe you won't meet those people, but you'll meet other amazing people.
Fuck, what was I going to say before I took this microphone?
Anna James is a radiantly beautiful person, and you should all seek out everything that she writes, including her forthcoming book.
Tell me about Anna James. You're going to splice that and put it right before what you said. Do 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 do.
All right, are we ready to hear the conversation that I had with the glorious and statuesque Anna James?
I'm ready.
Do 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 do.
Hi, I'm Anna James. I'm a writer and a journalist. And I basically have a very unexplainable job, but I do lots of things to do with books.
Yeah. Books, a professional books things doer. Yeah.
Basically, I'm a professional reader.
Yeah. I mean, professional reader sounds like the dream that, like, what academics would like to pretend we actually are when we're actually professional paperwork completers. Okay, so Anna and I, we are recording from a beautiful sunny flat in London. And a couple of days ago, we went and saw The Cursed Child live.
Thank you to Becca at Pottermore.
So we are going to chat today about our experience of watching The Cursed Child live. Let's get started. Okay, so you have seen this three times.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
Yeah, so three why three times?
Well, the honest answer is that I love stuff. and I have a super addictive personality. And I saw it for the first time and I was just like, I just need to see it again. Also, the awkward thing about a show that's in two parts and that isn't particularly cheap and is only in London is it is actually something that really rewards multiple viewings. And I just felt like, I live in London. Yeah. Why not just go and see it as many times as I can? I just feel like I'm never going to regret seeing it again.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the eventness of this thing, right? So this is a show that's obviously deeply appealing to Harry Potter fans all over the place. And it's something that, like, you're located in London. You can go to it multiple times. Lots of people will never be able to see this show.
Right.
Why? You're J.K. Rowling. You are deciding what the next thing you're going to do in your franchise is going to be. Why make a lavish, beautiful, permanent theatrical production in a city that most people in the world will never go to?
I mean, I don't know the answer to that.
No. Wild speculation is all we do on this podcast. Never research, never check if you're right. Just come up with opinions.
I'm there with that. Because I think the thing when you see it that is so obvious is how obviously it was conceived as a play. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's some cynicism from people who've just read the script that it is just, you know, it's just a money-making thing. But when you see it, this is created by people who love theatre and it is created as a show. Yeah. I feel like, was there not, I don't know, again, wild speculation. I feel like I read something that maybe the producers, like, I think she'd been approached, had she, by people. And so clearly people were encouraging this to happen.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it wasn't her idea, like, I'm going to experiment with theater. It was like some people approached her and were like, we have this idea. Mm. And the thing, when I got back to the flat of the people I'm staying with, the first question I got about it was, you know, so does it make sense as a play or does it just feel like another movie put on stage? It's profoundly a play.
Oh my goodness, yeah. Because it was really interesting being able to watch it. Because, you know, I listened to the episode where you talked about the script and I'm obviously, like, very aware of the way people have talked about the script and I totally understand so many of the frustrations. But when you see it on the stage, so many of those things just melt away.
Yeah.
And it's just, there's not to say it's perfect. And a lot of the frustrations in the script, you know, that's still the script. But there's so much to love about it as a performance.
There's two things there that I want to talk about at some point. I want to talk about the script and why the script is the worst part.
I was like, you're gonna have the best time because the script is, it's the worst bit of the show. Everything else is flawless.
And this is there's this little part of my brain that can't help but go a little conspiracy theory about how bad the script is. That feels like, so, you know, I've been chatting with a lot of people about events as the sort of quote unquote solution to the quote unquote crisis of publishing and how the event produces something that can't be shared for free online because the event by its very nature is sort of live and immediate and non-reproducible. And all you can buy is mediations of that event and like signs of that event, the sort of souvenir-esque things that let you go back to that. But in the same way that you can't reproduce travel via a souvenir, you can only remember it. So the willingness to sort of release the script feels to me not so much like here's something that if you can't make it to the show, you can still enjoy it. It feels more to me like look how totally the script does not reproduce the experience of the show.
And you know, when you said why have I gone to see it multiple times, I read the script once when I got it just out of interest, but I'm not interested in rereading the script. It's an experience. I want to go in. I don't want to hear those words, like the words are mediocre. The experience though, it's addictive and magical. And that's what I want to experience again and again.
I spent almost the entirety of the like 6 hours of this production with my mouth open. it's really so I just kept being like, what?
There were so many moments where you like, I could just see you turn to me being like, what? Did you see that? And I was like, yeah, I see. This is why I'm coming again.
Did you see that they did a magic on the stage? Let's talk a little bit about sort of the quality of the production first. So, I don't know, do you see a lot of theater in London?
Yeah, a fair amount, yeah. I would say.
So, like, tell me on the scale of, like, London theater, is this, like, a sort of over-the-top, flashy production? Is this...
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We talked a little bit about this in the interval, like, flashy, because it's incredibly impressive. Mm-hmm. And obviously expensive, but it's quite old school in many ways. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of, again, this is horribly spoilery, but there's not a lot of kind of fancy high tech. It's not a high tech show. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like people on stage doing clever things. There's a lot of very physical magic and just feels very old school in many ways, despite being obviously a very modern and fancy and expensive experience. Yeah. It's unlike anything I've seen on stage before, but partly because, you know, like I've never seen anything that you have to go and see two parts. It's just, it's the whole thing is unlike what you expect from a theatre experience. Yeah. It's hard to compare it to anything else because it's working on such different sort of beats. It's
The practical effects thing was so fascinating. And I really wish that Neil in particular could see this.
Aww.
Because I saw Neil give a really fascinating talk at the Edmonton Comic Expo a couple of years ago. Neil gave this fascinating history of London theatrical productions and the sort of fascination in Victorian era London theater with increasingly sophisticated practical effects being reproduced on stage and sort of pushing the edge of what you can do with theatrical technology. But the most amazing effect that you could do on stage in the Victorian era was set something on fire because there was a very real risk that you would burn the theater down and kill everyone.
I mean, I keep like feeling like I have to apologize for spoilers, even though we've already...
We'll put the sound effect in again.
But there was some pretty extreme fire going on.
Yeah.
Like, they save it for the climax, right? Like the climax scene where if you've read the script, it's the sort of showdown in the church where they are fighting the augury and the magic spells in that scene. And it's really one of the only scenes where we see magic happening.
Like things happening with wands. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that sort of Harry Potter, like, I'm going to zap you. Yeah. It's all done with fire, which was such an interesting choice.
Yes, and looked quite extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
The only really very kind of high-tech trickery, mm-hmm. which I was just, when I knew it was coming for the first time, I was just like literally watching you, not the stage, is when they do the time turner effect, which I've seen that several times now, and I don't really understand what's happening there.
So the effects are done primarily via trapdoors, lighting effects. There's very, very minimal use of projections. Mm-hmm. It's quite old school in the sense of there's a lot of use of just things on stage that extras come on and move those things around. And now they're a different room and you just see the people. Somebody in a cloak comes in and moves the thing and now it's a different room. Yeah, so for example, the time turner effect is like when they go back in time, there's this sort of pulse or ripple thing that happens that I am fairly sure is just light.
Right. Well, I mean, it must be, but it's incredibly impressive. And the most, I'm sure there's a lot of high tech stuff going on behind the scenes, but it's the only kind of like, ooh, technology sort of effect that you've got. Because I realized as well, the scene, I didn't notice this when I saw it before because I was sat further back, but... the scene where Draco and Harry are fighting, they're being picked up by people dressed all in black.
I didn't see that. I assumed it was wires.
Well, I think maybe some of it is wires, but there was one where Harry gets picked up that I saw the person retreat.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's literally there's people dressed all in black, like picking them up. It's so old school. Like, obviously, it's executed flawlessly.
Yeah.
Quite. And they do actually some... Harry does a blinding spell and it's literally you see someone with black gloves like put their hands like in front of Draco's eyes.
Yeah.
So there's this really fascinating way that rather than go, because they could have afforded to do every high-tech computerized thing in the world, but a lot of the time they're doing things that you can see. My favorite example was the way that often to make things disappear, like props that weren't necessary anymore, a bunch of, you know, unnamed wizards would come on and swoop their cloaks over those things and make them disappear like a magic show.
Yeah. It's fun. They are doing a very conscious nod to the fact that it's a show about magic.
Yeah. And sort of drawing on this dense history of theatrical magic, you know, there is already a vocabulary for showing magic on stage, right, which is magic shows. And rather than trying to make what they're doing something different, they're really sort of embedding it in that that theatrical tradition.
Which is all as well, again, it's rooted in the fact that this is obviously, this was conceived as a piece of theatre. Yeah. Everything is about that.
Yeah.
Which I hope like soothes some of the cynicism of people. Like, it's so, it's just beautiful.
Yeah. The score was remarkable.
Yeah. So the music's all done by Imogen Heap, which is a really interesting choice. And the music is very Imogen Heap-y. Like, at times there's even samples of her existing songs. Mm-hmm. But the score is, and again, this is, again, a bit of a tangent, but I'm just guessing we're going to talk about the movement. Because even though it's in no way a musical, there's some very highly choreographed, almost dancing moments.
Yeah, for sure, dancing, yeah.
And again, this is the thing that there's not even, I don't think there's even a reference in the script to it even happening. Mm-hmm. You know, at the beginning of the second part, there's this quite extended, incredibly sinister scene where Death Eaters, are they still called Death Eaters in the alternate? Anyway,
I'm not sure. It's in the sort of the third alternate timeline where Voldemort is reigning, and there you sort of come back after the break, or for some people the next day, and it's sort of re-immersing you. It's like, okay, now you're in this dark reality. When you come into the theater, the Voldemort banner is hanging, and then the opening scene is this stunning choreographed dance scene of
a good few minutes. Yeah. It's like a solid, it's not just them entering, it's a real scene, and there's swooshing cloaks and like this really like intense marching. They do this very like kind of rigid, it's beautiful to watch. But I don't think there's even a reference to, I think it literally starts with just the first bit of dialogue. And there are so many moments like that. Like, one of my favorite moments is when they are looking for Scorpius and Albus in the Forbidden Forest, and the sides of the stage move out to become trees. Mm-hmm. And they all have their wands lit and they're just searching, like, and they're moving organically. And then the music kind of changes and they move their wands just like in time with the music. And it's so beautiful, but there's not even a line. It's like they look for Scorpius and Albus in the Forbidden Forest. And there's so many moments that are just profoundly beautiful to watch that there's just nothing. It's not even a reference to them in the script.
Yeah. Whole aspects of particular characters too, that like, it was so confusing to me why, do you remember the name of the actor who played Hagrid in The Sorting Hat?
Chris Jarman,
yeah. So he, you know, he's listed as, when you come in and they sort of have the today's cast, he's listed as The Sorting Hat and other characters. And Hagrid is in fact just a sort of side character of his, because they make him as The Sorting Hat into this sort of omniscient magical figure who reappears in multiple scenes, often as a sort of unspeaking commentator on the action. And the moment that really struck me is the moment when, in the sort of third timeline, when Snape casts his Patronus, and it's the deer, and the effect is Chris Jarman as the Sorting Hat, dressed in his Sorting Hat costume, which is a suit and a bowler hat, which I freaking loved, holding this sort of Patronus prop, which is just the deer's head, literally lit on fire. And he's just moving it around. And there was something, I was about to say I'm probably reading too much into this, but there's no such thing. There's something about, you know, how Snape is treated as one of the examples of what happens when you sort too soon, and when you sort of tell people they're one kind of person and they have these capacities to be different kinds of people. And Snape as this sort of, you know, the Slytherin villain who turns out to have this tremendous capacity for heroism. And the fact that in that moment of his heroism, when you see, you know, his Patronus is what's inside of him, what he's capable of, the fact that it's the Sorting Hat that holds it, it's just like...
I know. It's, and do you know what, when I said I got goosebumps, I wasn't even thinking about that bit. I was thinking about the bit where they go to Godric's Hollow for the first time and he just emerges. And again, so hard to explain. And this, I guess, is why it's not in the script. It's really hard to explain it in words. But it starts snowing as they emerge in Godric's Hollow. And he comes and he does this beautiful, like, balletic kind of hand movement and spreads some of the snow. And he doesn't say anything. And it's just, it's beautiful. We need to talk about Snape because, right, I think most of the characters are true to the books. Yeah. I think Snape, the way Snape is written, has been influenced by the way the fandom sees him in a way that none of the other characters are. Because Snape is the Snape almost of the fandom.
Yeah.
Because Snape has become this thing that maybe isn't actually in the books. But he is, I think, in the in the play, he's kind of that Snape. He is heroic and brave, and there's none of the, you know, in the books, he's just, he's so mean and awful, and it's not, that's not there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had an interesting conversation with Rochelle yesterday, when she was saying that she recalled, as a sort of young reader, finding Snape fascinating and being really drawn to him. And I also remember finding him fascinating, and we were talking about the history of Gothic heroes and the sort of the trope, the Beauty and the Beast, the, you know, Rochester, the Heathcliff, the trope of the hero who is monstrous on the surface but has a capacity to be saved, and who specifically needs to be saved by a beautiful white woman, and how when you are a young girl reader, often for you, those are the only roles you get to imagine yourself into. That's the form of heroism that's available to you, is to save a man and make the world better by virtue of righting the patriarchal order and restoring everything to sort of the way it ought to be. And I think that is a big part of what Snape is to the fandom. That Snape is that Gothic hero. There is something really beautiful and moving about that capacity for redemption. That is why I hate Snape of the books. God damn if I didn't cry for him in this fucking play.
He's used so well. He's in such a small part of it that it lets him be what you want Snape to be, because he's in such a he's in such a small part of it. And it's really the moment they're very clever with the way they introduce characters. And again, huge spoiler, but there's the moment where Dumbledore first appears is it wasn't quite as extreme when I first saw it. I saw a preview and no one knew anything. And there was like a theater-wide like gasp when Dumbledore, he walks onto an empty stage and then the portrait frame comes down over him. But there is this moment.
He does some magic first too.
Right. Oh, he, it's after the trees have come out, isn't it? He like waves the trees away and it's just him on the stage. He walks forwards and then just very quietly the portrait comes down and you, but there, so clever with the way they introduce characters like Snape and Dumbledore who aren't on the cast list, and they it's a moment. You know when Snape, like, he's behind the chalkboard and it comes around, and there's and so
much love for those characters and recognition of the way that readers feel about them. They give them, they give them a moment.
The moment with Snape where, so you see him and his back's to you and he's standing in front of the chalkboard writing a very, the probably the closest thing to a version of a magical chalkboard that looked like a real lesson, that I, better than anything in the movies. And then he turns around and he's old. Because he is old now, right? And that, so I, here is why I am convinced by the Snape of the play, rather than the Snape of the books. Snape of the books dies before he ever really has to prove himself. Really. I mean, I know everybody, sorry, in preparation, hello, Twitter, please yell at me for 5 years now. Future people are going to be listening to this in a decade and come back, come find me wherever I am and yell at me about this. But he dies in the heat of things. There's a line when Scorpius says to Draco in, again, the third timeline, that he says he feels like we were all tested and we all failed. But Snape was tested, like really, really tested, like Dumbledore's not in power anymore. Harry Potter has died. You failed. You are released from your promises. You could just lean into this. Yeah. He was tested and he passed. Yeah. Like he has stuck with this his entire life far past it being glamorous, far past it being urgent.
Right. Do you know, and that also makes me think that for all of our dismissiveness of the script, it's not like, it's not, there's some beautiful moments.
Yeah.
Like that line is gorgeous. And the line that really gets me is when Dumbledore echoes, you know, he says to Harry the first time we see him, he says, you know, you can't ask me for advice. I'm just paint and memory. But then when you see him in the next part, he says, you know, some things endure like paint and memory. And oh my goodness, like, I think there was obvious issues with the script, but there are some beautifully done scenes and there were some gorgeous lines. And I feel like I just want to make it clear that I do like a lot about the script, even though I have some issues with it.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, we need to talk about the guy who plays Harry. What is his
Jamie
name?
Parker.
I mean, I guess he is a famous London.
He has a definite like cult following, which I wasn't aware of him before this, but then when, I mean, I'm like wary to even talk about him in a way that's going to go public because I just have a huge crush on him and it's so hot.
Absolutely outrageous how sexy Harry is in this play.
I'm so glad that you felt that too, because I feel like I like tweeted that the first time I saw it. But you have to see it. And also, again,
he's just wearing this three-piece suit and he just keeps putting his hands in his pockets and I was like, ah,
it just works. And he's so great. Also, then sometimes he cries and it's just, you know, the whole cumulative effect is just a lot.
He just cries and cares about his children a lot and wears a three-piece suit. And it was
such a great suit. Anyway,
I mean, the costuming and the entire thing was just spectacular, as would be anticipated. But
yeah, we should talk about, he's a great actor. Yeah. The thing with the script and the actors is when you read the script, there are clunky lines and you just think, how could that possibly not be incredibly embarrassing to watch someone perform that? But the cast is uniformly like excellent. Yeah. Like they're superb and they sell 99% of the clunky lines.
Yeah.
And you not just sell, like you are there and it's incredibly impressive. You can forgive so much when you're seeing it being performed by such talented actors.
Yeah.
You know, I loved Harry. I remember in my reading of the script feeling disappointed with Ginny's role. Right. And Ginny is splendid in it, and a really interesting part of it is the way she is very, very frequently on stage but not speaking.
Right.
And she's always there while our sort of three adult protagonists are talking and having drama and figure things out and fighting and blah, blah, blah. And Ginny's just there. And then at the very end of the play, she talks to Harry about her experience of being a lonely child and how she felt lonely watching them have these friendships. Mm. And so there is something really beautiful about the way that you see she's still there. She is fundamental to everybody's well-being.
Yes. And the relationship between Harry and Ginny is very convincing. Mm-hmm. And again, the actors are so good. Like, they sell it so well. And again, Ginny is one of those characters that I can absolutely see if you read the script.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because a lot of the dialogue, when you're not seeing the performance, you kind of think, oh, like the line about her being the editor of the sports page, you're like, oh, it's just a throw. It's like a nod. It's just saying like, Ginny's there. She has a real job. But there's so much more going on the stage. And she's very fierce. I'm wary of like using kind of cliched words about her being like a fierce mom, but she's very good. And like, there's a sort of very real strength to her that the actress really makes very clear physically when you see her on stage around other people.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month. I really liked the, it's such a sort of little stage convention, but they like color coded the protagonist. So Harry's always in dark blue and Ginny's in green and Ron is in orange and Hermione's in purple. And I loved Hermione in purple. Hermione in purple is like the queen of the wizarding world. Yeah. Just so regal, so powerful, so effortlessly authoritative in a way that's like, what happens when a bossy little girl finally gets to run shit? She just steps into that power.
And Noma Dumasweni is glorious as Hermione, just glorious. I think, again, the first time I saw it in previews, this moment is lost now the show has been out and everyone knows what happens. Mm-hmm. When no one knew that Hermione was Minister for Magic. That was like a moment. No one had read this. The script wasn't out. It hadn't been mentioned before. Yeah. And literally, I nearly burst into tears. And it's easy to forget when that's just now such common knowledge.
Yeah.
But watching that as a woman and who'd grown up with Hermione, there's this moment when it's just referred to and the whole theatre was just like, like, it was incredible. It was such a powerful moment. And I interviewed Noma, and she was saying that she hadn't really realized the power of that moment, but in all the previews, every audience reacted like that. And she was like, wow, this is important. But like, yeah, imagine like hearing that and not knowing that was coming. Because in hindsight, of course, she's the Minister for Magic. Yeah. But it was such a moment.
I've been thinking about that. I had like it entirely. You're right. Like I read the script and I'd forgotten it was a surprise. And some people have expressed to us that they are disappointed that both Hermione and Harry ended up working in government. But I feel like in the wake of the recent American election, when we all watch what happens to a woman when she tries to be in a position of power, it's been a few months now, and I feel like I have sort of like numbed over a bit. But like the first week after that election, as I thought over and over again about what had happened to Hillary Clinton and what had happened to all the little girls who were watching her, and I just cried every day. Yeah. I just cried every time. I was like, oh my God, people hate women so much. And I just cried about it every day. And getting to see Hermione Granger grow up and be Minister of Magic and not like, nobody is treating her like shit because she's a woman. Yeah. That's what I want in my fantasy worlds.
Yes, exactly. It's so powerful. Also, just on a more like logistical, it's not like we're presented with lots of job options in the Harry Potter world. Like if they're not working for the ministry, like, or the Daily Prophet, like what are, there's not,
or Hogwarts.
Yeah. There's not a huge amount of other jobs that we are aware of.
Yeah.
And so, like just logistically, like what else would they do? Just from a narrative perspective, it's the only option is to put them in things that are established. We understand how these places work. We can picture them there. We're not having to suddenly deal with this whole new working environment. Like also it puts them physically, puts Hermione and Harry physically in the same place, which is useful. I like their dynamic. I love the dynamic between the main three. It felt very true as friends who have gone through an awful lot and they've all grown as adults. It was very they have such great chemistry, don't they, on stage?
They really do.
Oh, speaking of performances, we need to talk good the main three are, because they're playing these like quite intense adult roles. And then there's the scene where Delphi, Alpus and Scorbius take the Polyjuice potion and turn into Ron, Harry and Hermione, and so of course you have Noma Dumasweni, Paul Thornley and Jamie Parker playing the kids as themselves. And that's when you realize, well, who's it like to say? It's like when you realize how good Helena Bonham Carter is in the film. You realize how good someone is when they're acting. Yeah. They are when they're
Jamie Parker is being Scorpius and tells Albus that he's been a really terrible son and he needs to go to his room right away. It's just...
You think you fancy Jamie Parker as Harry and then you see him act as Scorpius, who is like the best character in the whole thing. And it's just like... It's too much.
Okay. So the final original series character we need to talk about is Draco. And we do need to reference. So we looked up the name of the actor who played Draco in our performance.
James Howard.
Okay.
Who is a cover. Yeah. And it's normally Alex Price, who I have seen the other two times, who was brilliant. But
So James Howard was absolutely wonderful.
He was great.
Yeah.
But he is also objectively super hot.
Like sexy. He was very manly. Very, very moving. His scenes with Scorpius frequently made me cry. Yeah. Absolutely stunning. But there is this line towards the end where Draco says, I'm getting bossed around by Hermione Granger and I'm kind of liking it. And I was like, that's the hottest line in this entire play.
Right. And it's, when I've seen it before, it's like, it has got a frisson, but it's like, it's funny. Whereas when he said it, it was a bit like, oh my goodness. Like, whoa. Yeah.
The scenes between Draco and Harry were also really, really remarkable. Watching the way so much of their history played out across their relationship as adults, and that even though they were sort of on opposite sides of the battle when it happened, it's playing out in their lives in the same way. It's just this weight that they can't get past, and that has continued to sort of pressure their fraught relationships with their children. Like, they're both really struggling to be dads because they had either no fathers or incredibly abusive fathers and don't know how to move beyond that. And I loved the interplay between the two of them, that it was so much more subtle than sort of we're enemies. It was like, we share this fundamental set of experiences that now that we're not on opposite sides of a political struggle, we actually have more in common than anything else. Yeah. So those are the new people. Do you want to talk about Scorpius first?
Well, let's start.
Because otherwise we're just going to be saving him for last.
But I think I want to hear what you have to say, because, you know, fresh, you've seen it for the first time. I knew how great the actor was, and I had seen his performance before, and I knew that you were going to love him.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the actor's name?
Anthony Boyle.
Anthony Boyle. Okay. The voice. The first...
You know the actor is Irish? No. Yeah, in real life, he's Irish.
And probably doesn't have that particular inflection.
I would assume not, because I don't think... Yeah.
The inflection is this sort of like a little bit like a teenager whose voice is breaking, a lot of sort of very high-pitched modulations. It read to me, his performance read to me as like he played Scorpius so queer in the best way. He's he's funny and charismatic and vulnerable and goofy and just like heartbreakingly weird. Yeah. Like just this amazing, amazing kid who doesn't fit in to the world around him at all, who like weirds out his dad, who weirds out his teachers, who weirds out everyone who meets him because he's like desperate for love and totally incapable of hiding how he feels about anything, and just heartbreaking.
It's incredible to watch. Also, he is on stage probably the most of all the characters, I think.
It didn't occur to me before that he's kind of the protagonist, but he's kind of the protagonist.
I would say Scorpius is. He's on stage an awful lot, and he kind of carries that whole... There's that whole section in the alternate world where we're seeing it through his eyes. He's the protagonist.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking again of the conversation we had about, that Marcel and I had about the title, The Cursed Child.
Right.
And who that, like, there's aspects of the play that certainly seem to tell us that the cursed child is the augury. What's her actual name?
Delphi.
You know, particularly the image of the child in a nest, which really suggests, because the augury is the bird, and so it suggests that that's her. But sort of watching it, I was like, oh, I get it. They're all cursed children. Right. Like, this is absolutely everybody.
That's all of them.
Yeah. But it's also like Scorpius as this child who has grown up with this sort of horrifying story being told about him, and who has responded to that by just being so weird, by just like, and he gets to be sort of this truth teller figure as a result, right? That he doesn't really care what people think about him anymore, and so he just says whatever matters. And that, you know, he continues to play that role in the third timeline where it gets him into trouble, obviously. Mm-hmm. But that's another thing that sort of gives him the special role in the play, is that he is like almost like a sort of clown figure,
right,
in the like in the Shakespearean sense,
like the wise fool,
yeah,
in exactly. him. And he's physically as well kind of gently clowning, although mm-hmm. he's not sort of, it's yeah. not like he's falling over in funny ways, yeah. but
yeah. just but his body language is so, like, he's very long-limbed, yeah. and there's a lot of sort of big arm and leg movements and a lot of sort of theatrical slumping, and
yes, but also like little things, like he often like has his ankles like at a slightly awkward angle, yeah. and just brilliant.
Yeah.
The character is brilliant, and then the actor is just extraordinary. You know, he just won an Olivier Award.
Oh, did he?
For,
yeah.
for being good at acting?
Yes.
Okay.
And so did Noma Dumas-Bunny, and so did Jamie Parker. They are very good. They're very good. That's my critical opinion.
Very good at acting. That's gonna be on the poster.
They're great at acting.
Oh, stellar review. Okay, Scorpius, brilliant. Albus?
I think the actor is very good and does a very like quietly touching performance. And I think the scenes between Albus and Harry are beautiful. Mm-hmm. And again, cried
yeah.
a lot.
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah, he does a great sullen teenager. I think because those scenes between him and Harry are so well done, and you become convinced that there really is something broken in that relationship, yeah. that's really, really not working, and that, you know, when he tries to reach out to his father behaves very, very badly.
Right.
So the sullenness then feels earned.
Right. I mean, that line, I think, again, that's a great example of when you read on the script, like, Harry yelling at his son, well, I wish you weren't my son. And you yeah. think, how, that's a ridiculous thing for a father to say. Yeah. Like, how could... But then it's such a horrible and powerful moment. It's, yeah. oh, it's horrible to watch. And like both of them just sell it. So you can completely yeah. believe how Harry has got to a point where yeah. he would say that, which doesn't excuse it at yeah. all. But it's believable that they've reached that point. Yeah. It doesn't feel like melodrama.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. It actually reminded me really viscerally of the screaming fights I used to have with my mom, which I struggle to remember what we actually fought about, because mm-hmm. it's not the content. It's the experience of being a right. teenager and struggling against a parent with whom you have a right. highly charged relationship. And I remember having screaming fights and no idea what we fought about. I just remember the feeling.
Right.
Like the two actors are physically, they're right up in each other's faces. They're yeah. incredibly close to each other. Yeah. It's really like...
When Harry says that line, he screams it into Albus's face from an inch away.
Right.
It's slightly terrifying.
Yeah.
So tell me about your experience of watching Delphi sort of evolve over the three performances.
So I think Delphi is a tough character. I think that new characters are always going to be hard. And then when they're a villain, it adds an extra level of sort of just difficulty in introducing that character. The actress who plays Delphi is physically very small. Mm-hmm. And the first time I saw it, the issue was that she wasn't scary enough. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a physical scariness. I think the actress is doing a lot with what she's got. And also the character has a lot of exposition.
Mm-hmm.
And that is tough to sell. She's yeah. trying to be sinister and scary, and she has this monologue explaining what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's really hard for that to have any menace, because it's like, it's really explainy.
Yeah.
And I just noticed in this one that they have either the actress has made this decision, or they've decided sort of the producers have decided that her, she's physically a lot more sinister. So she's a lot more, when she takes Albus and Scorpius, she's a lot more like she's up in their faces and she touches Albus a lot. And they really play on that fact that Albus has a crush on her. Yeah. And she really like manipulates that in a really genuinely sinister way. You know, she touches his face and she's very close to him. And that wasn't really there the first time, and it made a huge difference to how sinister Delphia was. But I still think there are issues with that character, and I felt like at the end that whole thing with her wanting to meet her father, I feel like they struggled a little bit. I kind of wanted them to go more that she has more of a redemption. I kind of wish they'd kind of made her more like out and out properly evil, which I know you want nuance, but she's not scary enough, I don't think, to be properly evil. But equally, if they're gonna go with the like she just wants to know her father, I kind of wish they'd gone more with that, because it's not enough at the end. I didn't really, you don't empathize with her enough. And I kind of wish they just committed one way or the other, made her more sinister and a proper villain, or like actually really explored the impact of her childhood a bit more, because that kind of just comes out at the end, and it's impossible to really empathize too much because it's kind of just blurted out in an awkward exposition speech at the end.
The point is supposed to be she is also a lonely child, look what loneliness does to children. Like, this is the thing that they are telling us across the board. Draco basically has a monologue where he explains the theme of the play, and the theme of the play is it is incredibly lonely sometimes being a child, and that lonely children can go in dark directions. And that, you know, when Delphi sort of has her explanation, this is why I'm bad, and Harry says like, meeting your father won't undo it, you can never undo those years of being an orphan, which then resonates back to his anger at Dumbledore at leaving him alone for 11 years and then bringing him in later, which is like, you actually can't undo the damage you did to me of 11 years of loneliness.
And they really deal with that, and Dumbledore deals with that. Dumbledore has a few lines that are kind of like, they're kind of funny, but he makes like lines about like, he refers to like bad advice that he gave Harry, and some of them are kind of played for laughs, but they're really like, Dumbledore really acknowledges that maybe the way he did it was not the right way to do it.
One of the things that is specific to the experience of going to the theater is that, unlike reading a book or watching a movie, I mean, you can watch movies with other people. The distinct thing is that there are 1,300 other people in the room with you having audible reactions, right?
This is a big theater. Like, it's four tiers. There are 1,300 people in there. It's a big there's a lot of us.
And
they're small seats. You're really aware that there's other people there
just pressed right up against everybody around you, and there are moments like wonderful moments like that, right? So the example that we both remembered was when in the third timeline you find out that the way that Cedric surviving changed everything is that at the Battle of Hogwarts, Cedric killed Neville. And when that's revealed, there's like this ripple of like...
It's amazing. It's amazing. That's the only moment that all three times there's been exactly the same reaction.
Oh, interesting.
Because like I said, you know, there was a couple of moments where like that happened with Hermione... But that's so known. And I think that it's almost like a throwaway line.
Yeah.
And you would be affected by it in the script, but it's great. I was waiting for it and I also feel that there was someone quite close to us who was having very audible reactions to everything. Laughing and gasping and they were just living, having the time of their lives.
Yeah.
It was a teenage girl.
It was joyous though, because I think there's a performative element to being an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And you do kind of verbalize reactions in a way that you, if you were by yourself.
I've never gasped out loud while reading a book.
Oh, I definitely have. I do all the time. And actually, it irritates my husband frequently because he thinks something horrible has happened. And I'm like, no, sorry, just in the book. Yeah. But you do, and I think it's particularly with laughing, I think.
Yeah, we laugh more when there are other people around.
You know, it might be something that you would smile at, but, you know, you laugh because you're in this group setting.
Yeah, so, you know, sometimes those reactions sort of resonate with you and amplify your own experience, but there was this moment where the reaction of the audience was so at odds with my own reading, which was, it's, I think, the final scene. Harry and Albus are in the graveyard. And Harry is confessing to Albus his many fears, right? He says, you think that I'm Harry Potter and I'm not afraid of anything, but I'm actually afraid of everything. And he says, I'm afraid of the dark. And that line, like when I read it and then watching the way that Jamie Parker performs it, that line is like, I am so broken by what happened to me. Like, I will never be better. I'm not a hero. I'm not this flawless Gryffindor. I am so scared all the time. I am so flawed. And I cried when he said that line, I'm afraid of the dark. And I was just like, no, Harry. And the audience laughed.
Yeah. And I don't think people have laughed at that point when I've seen it before. But I have a constant frustration with audiences laughing in the wrong place. And I feel like, not that, it's all subjective. There's no such thing as laughing in the wrong place. But sometimes there is. Yeah. And sometimes you shouldn't laugh.
Yeah.
And it is strange to me. Yeah. That was a weird moment, wasn't it? Like. Yeah.
It was so jarring, and it was so like, I guess it's just the experience of being present, simultaneously experiencing a text and a text. Sorry, we just call everything texts. And actually being able to experience in real time somebody else reading it differently from you. And how, like, when you read, that happens after the fact. That happens when you sit down and talk about it and are like, oh, you read that like this? Oh, I read that like this. But to actually be like, everything has culminated in this, like, this quiet exchange between these two characters who have been at each other's throats for the whole play and are now, like, Harry's now finally really opening himself up. He's doing what Ginny told him he had to do and showing Albus a really specific love.
Yeah, that's such a lovely... It's so...
That's a wonderful line.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I feel like I have nothing, like, no... like caught in this script, but I am feeling really guilty about, like, there's some really nice bits too.
There are some wonderful lines, and that's a wonderful line.
Yeah.
And
but it's interesting because obviously it's valid that we all read things differently.
Yeah.
But when you're seeing a play, Jamie Parker is making very specific decisions, and I think why it jars is because his performance is hard to read as funny.
Yeah.
His performance seems very obviously like powerful and sad, and that's why it's jarring that people laugh, because on the page you could read it however you want, but there's a very specific performance choice going on right in front of you.
It took me out of the moment in a very particular way, which is to say, I stopped thinking of that person as Harry and started thinking of that person as Jamie Parker, and was like, fuck everybody in this room, you all just responded wrong. Like, he is up there. He is, like, wearing his heart on his sleeve. Yeah,
I'm crying, Jamie. Yeah. I'm crying.
I see what you're doing. I understand you.
I was just about to say something really inappropriate, but...
Yeah, my head also went there. now put your hands in your pockets again.
I was just about to say exactly that.
Okay.
It's a great suit.
Yeah, it's really, it's just a,
the thing is, it's a great suit is the thing.
Like, oh my goodness, speaking of good performances and the audience being annoying, the bit where they stand, so when they watch Harry's parents be killed, the main characters are all lined up at the very front of the stage because Voldemort has walked through the audience and they are looking up as if it's happening behind us.
Yeah.
And the audience kept like turning around as if like you could see like Lily Potter being murdered at the back of the theatre. And I was like, they're looking as if it's happening, but we're watching them, they're performing, and people were just like like straining around. I'm like, there's nothing happening behind there. But that performances were when he like breaks down
so that moment, that's an incredible moment. We talked about this in our episode about the script, but that moment of being called upon to bear witness, that Harry is sort of being brought back and bearing witness to his own originary trauma, and that we as an audience are being called upon to bear witness. The friends are all there to bear witness with him, and they stand by him and they all watch, but we don't. Like, that's the point. Like, people are craning around because they want to watch what these actors are watching, but we don't get to see it. We have to witness them witnessing. And so what we have to look at is, like, when he breaks down in that scene, he shatters. Yeah.
And all of those actors make such incredible choices there. Like, you know, like Scorpius is quite stoic, and then he just, that moment where he turns around and Draco just like wraps him up, like,
it's only the second time they've hugged in the play, and it's so beautiful.
It's just, it is Draco and Scorpius, that relationship is.
Yeah.
So this comes with the proviso of, I never really believe J.K. Rowling when she says she's done with Harry Potter.
Okay.
But I actually, the end of that play does feel like it's, you know, you read the books and there was that epilogue and you could tell that she wasn't done with those characters. Also because she will not shut up about the characters. But actually, it was so much more final. The end of that play is like, it feels a lot like this is the end of these character stories. Like, we've checked in on them and they are essentially, they're going to be okay.
Yeah.
And coming full circle on the way the book begins, it feels like the actual end of the Harry Potter. Yeah. And again, I don't like, she obviously, but I could see, you didn't get that feeling that you get at the end of the epilogue where, there was a level of closure, I think.
Well, and there was that, you know, that frustration with the epilogue in the way that it suggested so strongly that history was going to repeat itself, that the same old animosities were still there, that the world had returned to exactly the same way it had always been. And there's something about the way that the play ends that suggests the possibility for something new. And it's that, you know, it's going to be a beautiful day. That there is potential, and a potential that's really nascent in Albus and Scorpius's relationship.
Right.
This potential for something actually different. One of the standout things for me was that so much of what is remarkable is the stuff that's happening around the edges of the dialogue, the sort of physical motion, the unspoken glances, the, you know, things like that, that I think also really do, like, you know, maybe go back and reread the script and spend more time thinking about, I mean, this is actually when you teach theater how you do it, right? Spend more time thinking about where people would be in relation to each other, how people, you know, in this scene, how would these two characters be, you know, would they be close together? Would they be far apart? How's this person feeling while they're overhearing this thing? You know, they're on stage. Like, if you were feeling disappointed in the script, I would sort of encourage you to go back and think about it again as a script and think about all of the other, you know, if you were going to stage it, what would it look like? If you were going to imagine a performance of this line that sold it, what would that performance be?
Also, put on an Imogen Heap album whilst you read it. And that's not even a joke, because the music is, you can tell it's being composed by Imogen Heap and the music is incredible. I am sure they will release
the soundtrack,
the score at some point. Yeah.
Yeah, it is incredible. And then eat a tiny tub of ice cream and you're there.
Right. Yeah. Sorted. You know, get a cast picture up on your laptop. You know, imagine some of those actors.
We got a picture of Harry in a suit.
What is this world? What is this? I can't believe I fancy Harry Potter. Like, what is happening?
Gross. This is as hetero as this podcast has ever gotten.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I blame you. On that note,
what a way to end.
Thank you. Well, we'll just edit. Well, I'm going to take out 75% of the references to Harry Potter's suit. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back, witches. Marcel, just, we were having a little chat while you were listening to my conversation with Anna, and Marcel just announced to me that she is part of the Inebriati, which is a phrase I've never heard before, but fucking love.
Just, you know what? Just YouTube Inebriati. That's all you got to do. And I want you to know that I am part of it.
It is time for the first of our two new segments. The first segment is not so much new as a new every episode feature. From now on, we will be doing a regular Witch Please Tell Me segment. So if you have a question about one of our episodes, about something in the Harry Potter world, about life, tweet at us with the hashtag Witch Please Tell Me. And we will choose our favorite question for every episode and come at you with an answer in this segment.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to be very, like, all over the place with the types of questions that we choose. So really don't feel like any question is too small or too big or too silly or too serious. We will go through them. And whatever just strikes our little harpsichords, we will answer that question.
Oh my god, you said strikes are little harpsichords and I just fell in love with you all over again. Okay, and our second end of episode segment, and this is a new segment, is a segment we are calling Try Witches Tournament. In this segment, we are going to set you, our beloved listeners, a challenge. And if you complete that challenge, you can tweet it at us with the hashtag TryWitches. That's TryWitches, TryWitches, to tell us what you accomplished, and we will give you shout outs on the episode.
So the first challenge, looking back a couple of weeks ago when we asked you to tell us what are some really hard things that you have survived or avoided doing this last semester, because it was a really hard semester for everybody, and you told us and it was amazing and you all just loved each other so much and gave each other so much support and it just made us cry a whole lot, and we thought this would be a really good idea to do on the reg. So what we want to challenge you to do this time is do that thing that you have been putting off doing because you're scared to do it, but you need to do it. Do it and then tell us that you've done it. And we're going to tell you that you did a really good job, because you did. You did a good job. That's a preemptive shout out to you for doing a good job, because things are hard. I'm crying already.
I have one. You know what I'm going to do?
What?
I am going to initiate the process in Vancouver to get gene tested to find out whether or not my mother's breast cancer was genetic. No. That is something that I should have done maybe a decade ago, but I am absolutely terrified. Yeah. And it involves a lot of negotiating medical systems, which I often find intimidating as a fat person. I know that I'm going to get possibly some bullshit from some doctors. Add to that the like trauma of having to revisit my mother's illness. I've been putting it off for a really long time, but I turned 33 today and it's time for me to do that scary thing. And so that's what I am pledging to this community, that I am going to start to do whatever is necessary to actually get that testing done.
You're going to do a really good job. In a similar vein, I'm going to tell my grandfather, who has very late stages prostate cancer, that I love him when I see him soon. And I'm already crying because it's really hard to talk about feelings to my grandpa. Not because I don't love him, but because talking to that generation of men about feelings is complicated and challenging. And I love him very much. And we're probably both going to cry and everything is fine. No, you're crying. Stop it.
Nope. Nobody's crying. Shut up. Nobody's crying. No crying on birthdays. All right, that's enough. That is enough out of both of us. We are looking forward to the rest of the season. We're so excited to be making episodes again. Thank you so much to everybody who has stuck with us through our much needed hiatus. It's really helped to make this project that we love so much sustainable. We are delighted to say that we'll actually be back in 2 weeks with another episode. But until then,
later, witches!
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.